Hello, my name is Matthew Kidman, and welcome to the latest episode of Success and More Interesting Stuff, brought to you by Livewire Markets. A revolution has taken place in share investing since the turn of the century. American firms have led the charge, with the likes of Vanguard and BlackRock taking passive investing around the globe. Disenchantment with active fund managers has seen funds flow into the passive sector, accelerated by the emergence of exchange-traded funds, or simply ETFs. In Australia, the revolution arrived late. Active managers held sway for many years before eventually the dam wall broke. The American behemoths came hard, but they didn't have it all their own way. Aussie startup BetaShares grew out of the GFC and took up the fight. Cobbled together by Alex Vinokur, an immigrant from the former Soviet Union, it wasn't long before BetaShares captured the attention of market participants around the country. 15 years on, and BetaShares has more than 90 ETFs, 37 billion of assets under management, and 150 employees. It is the second largest ETF provider in the Aussie market, and in 2023 managed to rank number one for inflows with 37% market share. As a 16-year-old, Vinokur and his family left the Ukraine as the walls of the former Soviet Union came crumbling down. Alex had no English and had to start from scratch. He caught on quickly though, and in a few short years was studying law at UNSW. A brief stint working as a lawyer was followed by a job at finance house Pengana with Malcolm Turnbull and Russell Pillemer. He deduced that not all active managers were able to beat the market. Around the same time, he latched onto the emergence of ETFs. Mortgaging his house and taking time for a fact-finding tour of the US saw him kick off BetaShares. Welcome, Alex.
Great to be with you, Matthew.
Thanks for coming in. Now, we've had about 30 guests. I think you're the 31st guest on Success and More Interesting Stuff. And we've had all different types of market participants. We've had journalists even. We've had active managers. We've had CEOs. But you're the first representative, and don't get upset if you don't like this, of the passive side of the market. So we're breaking new ground.
Fantastic.
A bit hard for an old active manager like me. Well, let's cut to the quick before we get into the good stuff of your background. Do you think active management is dead? Because last year in Australia, passive fund flows, for the first time, as far as I'm aware, outstripped active fund flows. And that's been a trend coming for a long time. So active managers, is my profession dying or slowly decaying?
Great question. Well, look, we're locked in a small room here, so I better be careful what I say. But look,
you're safe with me.
I am very positive on the future of active management, actually, and it may come across as somewhat counterintuitive coming from the founder of BetaShares. But I genuinely am very bullish and very positive on the future of active management. I think asset management as an industry has grown tremendously, obviously, over many, many decades, all over the world. Asset management has not gone through a period of disruption until ETFs came about, which is about 20 years ago now.
And the first ETF was in the US?
Yes. The first ETF, interestingly enough, is in Canada. So Canada. Poor old Canadians don't get enough credit, for that. But most people assume that it's in the US. But look, like all industries, asset management is going through a period of change. Change is painful. Change is uncomfortable. There are very high quality active managers who are embracing change and looking to reposition and evolve their business models, evolve their offering to clients in light of the changes that are taking place. Of course, there are always those who tend to bury their head in the sand and pretend that nothing is happening. I think those will feel the pain a lot more. But genuinely, I feel that asset management is going through a period of change, evolution. ETFs are definitely shining a spotlight on those active managers, or I should use inverted commas, active managers, that are index huggers in particular, benchmark aware.
Those long only old managers that used to dominate the Australian scene anyway, but I presume globally, their days are numbered. It looks like they have been for a while, but definitely.
Yeah, look, I think investors, in my experience, and I speak to investors all over the world, not just in Australia, they want active managers to be active. They want them to put, you know, to put their reputation, their name, you know, on the line. They want them to make hard conviction calls, whether it comes to asset allocation in the multi-asset context, whether it comes to picking winning stocks, if it comes, if it comes in the long only, equities or bond, context. People want active to be active. And of course, we have a very significant part of the industry, which is private assets. We're talking about private credit, private equity, venture capital. I mean, this is the space where you need to wear out the shoe leather. Those parts of the asset management ecosystem are not as amenable to indexing or quantification, for lack of a better term.
I haven't got any data on those, but those assets you mentioned there have grown strongly in the last decade or so.
They have, and this is the bifurcation in the asset management industry that I have been observing now for 5 to 10 years. We are seeing two ends of the spectrum really growing fast. So beta, basically, broadly speaking, and of course beta or indexing has evolved a lot over time. At the time we're starting beta shares, it was market cap weighted indices predominantly, and people were saying, well, why do I need to buy, MSCI World, basically, or how many versions of MSCI World do I need? I think what we've seen, which has been really exciting, is a world of innovation in the space of indexing. Now you have factor exposures, quality, value, whatever you want. There are thematic equity products that have evolved in the market that we haven't seen before. Today, asset classes such as fixed income are available on the ASX, basically. 20 years ago, that was not even a possibility. Mm-hmm. So there has been so much exciting evolution, basically, in the world of indexing. And again, going back to active asset management, I think the quality managers are looking to evolve their business model, looking to evolve their proposition to the customer. And that is the reason why I think longer term, the evolution and the arrival of ETFs, I actually think will be a great catalyst for the next wave, basically, and the next incarnation of what active management is all about. And also, just to close the loop, ETFs are not just about indexing. I mean, the vast majority of ETFs in Australia are index tracking. However, the beautiful thing about ETFs that I have learned since we kicked off the business is that the user experience of an exchange-traded fund is the user experience that investors expect in 2024. The user experience of an unlisted managed fund, in particular when the underlying assets are liquid, is really the experience that people may have expected in the 80s or the 90s. Mm. So the evolution of the user experience of the ETF, being able to see what you invested in, to know the price at which you're buying and selling, to be able to rebalance your portfolio, that's really the user experience of the future, basically. And I think ETFs have really tapped into that user experience as much as performance net of fees.
That's really interesting, because the way you just described it to me then about where active managers are heading or being forced to head is to actually be active. And effectively, they're taking risk to do that, which makes it a harder job. Like you want to get returns without a lot of risk, but going down that path, that's risky. But one thing that's also interesting is, as the ETF model slightly evolves, as you were talking about there, the old tracking of the MSCI or the All Ordinaries or whatever major index, that's kind of in place. But now we've gone a bit more exotic, and different ETFs for different sectors, different themes. Do you think that actually heightens the risk? Which I imagine a couple of reasons why ETFs were so popular. One, they were cheaper.
Yep.
Two, you could get exposure to something without taking a lot of risk. So you didn't have to stock pick anymore. You could buy the index, which we know has got less risk attached to it than individual stocks. But as you go and become, as I use that word, a bit more exotic and bring in different types of ETFs that are more specialised, do you bring back in that risk that people were trying to avoid in the first place?
Yeah. Look, it's a really, really great question. I think, just looking at statistics first and foremost, the vast majority, over 90% of all ETF investors actually use what we call in the professional circles a core satellite approach, basically. In other words, they will use ETFs as building blocks for the core of their portfolio. That core is going to be diversified, that core is going to be cost effective, and that core, quite often, is going to be multi-asset, which is really, really important. But again, we are all human. And as humans, we are observing changes that are happening around us all the time. Changes in the world present investment opportunities. In the days when we were all limited as investors to picking stocks, those investment opportunities would normally be pursued with stock picking, basically. Today, the investment universe has been broadened, and the implementation for those investment opportunities has been broadened to also include ETFs. So if I pick an example, cybersecurity. Cybersecurity is an industry where at the time of founding of BetaShares didn't really exist. I mean, people knew, of course, that cybersecurity is coming up. It's an issue. People, were aware of early examples of hacking, but nobody really thought about cybersecurity as an industry that it is today. So in the old days, you'd call up your broker or your financial advisor and say, hey, I think cybersecurity is a really interesting space. How do I participate in that? And again, that's human nature. People kind of pick on trends, they pick on opportunities, and they say, okay, that's a really great space. What would tend to happen is that your advisor would say, listen, it's a really great space, I agree. By the way, we've got two stocks on the ASX, basically. And, who knows whether those stocks are actually great, the best way to play, that global thematic or not, but you'd end up essentially buying what's on your exchange. With the evolution of ETFs, you can have a cybersecurity ETF, and that provides an investor with A, diversified, B, best of breed in terms of global access, and C, still the same convenience as buying a security on the ASX. So the reason I'm giving that example is that very few people put the entirety of their wealth in MSCI World, and they say, okay, I'm just going to watch that. I'm just going to watch that, over time. We're human. We have emotions. We invest because we have interest in the subject matter. And I think what ultimately is happening with exchange-traded funds, it just broadens the horizons. It broadens the menu. It gives people more opportunities to express their view. And I think, critically, it allows us to build a core of our portfolio, which is exactly what we want it to be, which is cost-effective, diversified, and at the same time provide an opportunity for engagement, basically.
Yeah, it's definitely a different way of putting your portfolio together as a core of it. And it also, it helps a little bit, doesn't it, if you can call it cybersecurity ETF. I know what to look for.
Yes.
Well, companies are harder to find.
Yes.
And dig out. But it also, I suppose the other great part of it was it allowed Australians, in your case, where you're providing it, to get global exposure, which was up until not that long ago quite difficult to do. And now this is a very simple way of doing it.
I'm really glad that you're bringing up that point, Matthew. For me, one of the first objectives that I had for us as a business in the early days of BetaShares is really to open up access to opportunities to Australian investors. I mean, it can sound a little bit ridiculous in 2024 because we've been in business now for quite some time. There are other peers that we have in the market that have been doing phenomenal job in enriching the world of investment opportunities for Australians. But our economy is really dominated by the financials and the resources, right? Industries. And those sectors are significant. ASX 200 is to a large extent a representation of those two, plus a smothering of others, of course. We have to look, as Australians, we have to look outside of our own backyard in order to tap growth opportunities for the long term. I mean, our superannuation industry is the pride and joy of Australia, and I think it should be viewed as the pride and joy of our financial system. I mean, when I travel around the world, whether I travel to North America, Europe, or Asia, people talk about our superannuation system as an incredible asset to Australia, and I certainly wholeheartedly agree.
Definitely.
However, we have a responsibility to invest our superannuation responsibly. We have an opportunity and a need to invest it thoughtfully, and in the case of Australian market specifically, we have over a third of our what now is almost a $4 trillion industry, which is completely self-directed with SMSFs, right? So unless our SMSF investors, and I just use that as a case in point, just as an example, have access to opportunities globally, We would always be looking only on our own backyard, and that's no way to build a portfolio for the future.
Yeah, there's just enough product for the amount of money coming in, which is great. We get to see the world. Let's keep playing a little bit of defence.
Yes.
Like the critics have said, especially those who have been active over the years rather than index huggers, the active investors. The critics will say that we get biases appearing in markets because big stocks, larger in an index, they keep getting buying. Products like ETFs will exacerbate that, while other stocks that might be smaller get forgotten a little bit. So you get this exaggeration when money keeps heading the same way because it's index related in some form. Do you think that is an issue that needs to be worked through, or is that just something that old active managers, you know, bring up just because they've got their head in the sand and they need to change?
Yeah. Well, look, I come back to the fact the wonderful thing about our market is that it's dynamic. And it continues, to reflect, of course, investor behavior and investor preference, but it will continue reflecting investment opportunities as they arise from time to time. I mean, right now, sitting here in Australia, ETFs represent 4% of the managed funds industry. You know, we've been hard at it for over a decade, and we still represent only 4% of the managed funds industry. There is still a long way to go for the growth of the ETF industry, no doubt. I do not know where the equilibrium is.
You know, that was going to be my next question.
Is the equilibrium...
do we end up 50-50?
Yeah, nobody knows. I think, I honestly, hand on heart, have no idea whether the equilibrium is 50-50 or 60-40 or 30-70 or 70-30. Nobody knows, but the reality is the equilibrium will be achieved at some stage. And if we were in the outrageous example, and it is an outrageous example because it's not realistic, where all of the money was following the index, it would be an incredible time to be an active manager because there'll be so much inefficiency in the market. There'll be so much opportunity to add alpha, to add value net of fees, that the money, of course, would start shifting to the other end of the equilibrium. So I think the market and the industry is in the period of adjustment. I think the great thing, as I mentioned previously, from my perspective, is that active managers are actually starting to become a lot more serious about being active. And again, I'm using it as a generalization. It's not a fair generalization. There are active managers that have been active, you know, for decades, and they're sticking to their knitting as well. But our industry, you know, has been dominated by index hugging, index aware. Take a little risk. I don't want to be the bottom quartile. If I'm second quartile or third quartile, I don't get fired. I think the days of that style are going to be more challenged, basically. So back to the point, equilibrium, I think we're going to be searching for. I don't know where it is. I do know that ETFs have a significant future ahead as an industry, but that future will involve both index tracking ETFs and active ETFs, because the user experience of an exchange-traded fund is irrefutably superior to that of an unlisted vehicle. I think the only exception that I will note, which I had referred to earlier, is that if you have underlying assets which are inherently illiquid, whether it's physical infrastructure, physical real estate, you know, private equity, venture capital, private debt, there's lots of examples. Those are inherently suitable for an unlisted fund structure because liquidity of an ETF should always reflect the liquidity of the underlying pool of assets.
Definitely, definitely. And structurally, do you see any problems with the ETF market in terms of what you just mentioned there? Liquidity in some products, some products are geared, which at various times, as we know, can bring people undone. Do you have any thoughts on that and what people should be investing in, and should those products be not as exotic, that they should be more representative of what the title says?
Yes. Well, look, I would say, like all great things in the world, any innovation, if taken too far, can backfire. And our view at BetaShares is that we want to make sure that the products we launch in the market are true to label, they deliver what they promise, and they always reflect the liquidity that investors expect, you know, from that asset. I mean, those are really key non-negotiables, I'd say, for us. And I think the vast majority of participants in our industry in Australia have been sticking to the same set of principles. Certainly in some of the markets like the US, which is a lot more developed today, we have definitely seen, you know, some pretty, what I would say, funky exposures. You know, we've seen like, you know, double geared inverse volatility ETF, which was allowed to list in the US. I think in Australia, it actually would not even clear, you know, the regulatory hurdle. I guess that's one of the benefits probably of Australian industry being some years behind where we are in the US, is that we have a bit of a Steve Bradbury, you know, sort of advantage basically of skating, you know, sort of some 50 meters, or in his case, probably a few hundred meters, you know, behind the leaders. And we can see what unfolds basically.
Yes,
so I think our regulatory setup in Australia is quite strong. We do have the benefit of watching others, you know, occasionally make mistakes, but this is certainly not a reason to be complacent. So I think we need to hold ourselves as a business and as an industry to a pretty high bar to make sure that the innovation that ETF, you know, has become known for does not get pushed too far.
And you've got some, talk about funky, you've got some pretty funky names.
Yes.
They are descriptive. I like the one, the bear.
Yes.
ETF, that's quite good.
Yes, bear. And
who comes
hack,
up, who,
I didn't mention hack.
Hack,
which is a cybersecurity. I mean, those are pretty.
Who's in charge of the names?
Oh, look.
Is that you?
No. I'm the least creative person in the business. You would not want me anywhere near, you know, those decisions. We do have a small group of enthusiasts who always throw some ideas around. You know, both for the names and for the ASX tickers. The one thing, actually, back in the day when we launched our first ETFs, you could only do three letter codes. And that was a bit of a little quirk of the ASX. I think they could only support three letter codes, or back in the day, I think we had warrants basically as well. I think warrants had six letters. So one of the really exciting innovations that I remember, we're very proud, was like actually to be able to have like four letter codes. So for example, hack couldn't have happened, you know, without.
It was strange, wasn't it? The three letters, because the US has had two and four and
yes.
five oh, yeah. over
and
the
one.
Years.
And one. One, yeah, yes, yeah, yes.
Yeah. And then we got numbers. Geez, that confused simple people like me. But
yeah.
We got that's good. Well, tell them to keep on coming. We like the names.
Yes, thank you.
So how did we get here? Let's go back into the past. You've got a pretty famous story that you're a child of the Soviet Union, which we mentioned in the introduction. You were there until your mid-teens.
Yep.
Enough to formulate ideas and an outlook on the world, which would have been a bit different then. But you're also a child of the Ukraine, which we'll talk a bit about later, not just the Soviet Union, but Ukrainian, which now is obviously, you know, a whole story in itself. So what was it like back in those days, growing up in a very insulated Soviet-style environment, or in the Soviet environment? It hardly fertile grounds for an entrepreneur.
Well, look.
Or am I wrong there?
No.
Prove me wrong.
Yes. No, it's going to be very hard to prove you wrong. I had a great childhood. I was born into a very kind, very loving family. A lot of my family, unfortunately, have died during the Second World War. And, you know, a big part of my upbringing was really appreciating peace. Appreciating simple things.
It's been a tough part of the world going back a couple of hundred years.
It has been very hard. But, you know, appreciating simple things in life, appreciating family, appreciating friends, appreciating peace. The one thing about Soviet Union is that everybody was more or less equal, basically. People were equally poor, but they were more or less...
That was the idea, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right.
Everyone was the same?
Yes, exactly. But people were pretty much equal. I had an amazing childhood. I was in a way, you know, on the one hand, surrounded by love from my family, and you know, I was brought up to really enjoy simple things in life. Basically, I had a good childhood. I was into sport. I was just hanging out with my friends. My grandfather, who lost both of his parents when he was 11, unfortunately, just when the war broke out, he was a person that I was very, very close to. Of course, in addition to my parents. And my grandfather had a life of real adversity, having to go through the entire war as an 11-year-old with no family around you, just really having to...
Great survivor.
..figure things out for himself. He was a very inspirational, person to me. He never, came across a problem that couldn't be solved, basically. Mm. And his mindset was on focusing on the solution rather than the problem. He couldn't finish school, of course, just given that, the war interrupted life. But, even without, formal education, he was very smart. He was very switched on. I've learned a lot from him. And, the one thing I've learned from him is that how hard it was to be entrepreneurial in communist Soviet Union, basically. Any ideas that he had were immediately, sort of squashed, basically. And it was really impossible to genuinely be entrepreneurial. And I picked up bits and pieces even from him around it. And of course, I had no idea as a child that we will end up immigrating to Australia. I'm going to have an amazing opportunity in life to be educated in this great country, and eventually will have an opportunity to build a business of my own. But as I track back to my childhood, I've definitely picked up quite a few lessons along the way about the value of creative thinking, the value of trying to be entrepreneurial, even though at the time in that environment it was not possible.
Well, you don't have to be in business to be entrepreneurial. As you said, it's about generating ideas and trying to put them into place. So maybe that's where you got it from. But just listening to what you've said before, previously about your parents, that they were always pretty keen to, if they got the opportunity, to depart the Soviet Union and what became the Ukraine later on. Do you think your grandfather was instrumental in their way of thinking, saying there's a better place for you guys to go to if you get the chance?
100%, 100%. We were keen to leave, or my family was keen to leave, for a while. With Soviet Union, it was very difficult to leave. And as soon as Soviet Union fell apart, my family started thinking about applying, and we were very fortunate that we got accepted to come to Australia.
I imagine they applied to a few different places.
Yes, we've applied to a few different places. My mother has a sister who actually, her family escaped basically the old Soviet Union, and they ended up in Australia through through a few other stops basically along the way. And Australia was a place that we were very lucky to be accepted to come.
I imagine when you were about that age and about to depart the Soviet Union, that financial markets had not really been mentioned in the family at all.
No, not
that
at
was,
all.
That was as foreign as anything.
That's right. Look, I still remember. First of all, people didn't really have a lot of money to invest in any event, right? I think that's the byproduct of the Soviet system. But I do recall that whatever savings we had as a family, you would be able to invest them in what at the time were bearer bonds, basically. Mm-hmm. So the government actually issued bearer bonds, and you could buy them in denomination of, whatever it was, like equivalent of, $10 or $50, basically. And you would not be paid any return on those, but it's a way of safekeeping your money.
No interest.
It was the equivalent, a better equivalent of keeping cash under the pillow, basically under the mattress, as people would say. But eventually, those bonds basically were difficult to access. And a lot of people were literally keeping cash, whatever cash they had, they were keeping them under the mattress, basically, or hidden somewhere. And what was one of the nails in the Soviet system's coffin was a change in the currency. So this is going back, obviously, many, many years. The government at the time chose to introduce new currency. So the old 50 and 100 ruble notes were decommissioned, mm-hmm. and the entire savings that people had that they were keeping, basically in those notes, have essentially been rendered worthless.
Oh dear!
There were some horrendous, experiences that I still remember, as a child, basically, and again, those were very early days, but I was thinking, there's smarter things to do with your money, basically, than keeping it in cash and have it evaporate.
So you land in Australia, you get the nod, the family gets the nod, and you turn up at Bondi, which these days we'd say, well, that's not a bad option. But in those days, in the 90s, there was a big Russian, as we call them then, but
yes.
ex-Soviet Union community down in Bondi.
Yes.
And that's where they started, like a lot of immigrants in Australia.
That's exactly right. We were incredibly, incredibly fortunate to have come to Australia, as I mentioned, to land in Sydney and land in Bondi. I mean, it was incredible. It was incredible. I have never seen anything like that, of course, in my life. I still remember, and it was 1994, and it was literally last week. It was 30 years since we immigrated to Australia. I still remember the first time I walked into a supermarket. It was Woolies in Bondi Junction. It was the old, you know, sort of Woolies before Westfield in Bondi Junction was developed. And we were all in a sense of shock when we walked into Woolies and we saw that you could buy like 10 different types of bread. I mean, I had to line up, I remember with my grandmother, like at 6:30 in the morning to get bread in Soviet Ukraine, because if you rock up at 8, you won't have it, basically. It's just, you know, it's not available anymore.
Gone.
And we walk into Woolies and you have like all these types of bread available, not even to mention a wild choice of fruit and vegetables, most of which I haven't seen before in my life, basically. It was really, really incredible. It was incredible.
The things we take for granted.
Oh,
We're very exciting. But it's interesting for you. You've turned up with no English, but within a few short years, you're studying law.
Yes. Well, they obviously had very low standards.
Am I exaggerating that?
They had very low standards back in the day.
It doesn't sound like it, because the UNSW, where you went, was a very good, it still is, very good law school. So you came here and you had to learn English and then study in an English system.
Yes.
So must have been a great student.
Well, listen,
You can put the modesty away.
Where I was genuinely lucky is that the Soviet education system was phenomenal in sciences. So when I got to Australia, I picked, you know, for my HSC, I picked 4-unit maths and 4-unit science, as any old Soviet nerd, you know, sort of would do. And I was lucky in that, first of all, I had the right, you know, sort of background, you know, sort of in maths and science. And it was a lot easier on me in that I didn't have to spend anywhere near as much time on those subjects, which actually allowed me a great deal of time, you know, to really at least improve, you know, sort of my basic English. I read a lot. And again, just thinking about childhood, I was really into detectives. Agatha Christie was one of my favorite authors. And I read everything I could, you know, sort of back in Soviet Union, of course, translated into Russian. Most of the books were translated into Russian. Few were translated into Ukrainian. And again, when I got here, I started reading those same books in English. And because I knew what the story is all about, it actually helped me a lot just connect the dots, basically. And again, the brain, obviously, you know, when you're 15, 16, still, you know, very capable of making connections. And it was just super lucky. It gave me like an accelerated way, you know, to at least, you know, learn the basics. As you can tell, I'm still learning. But it definitely helped a lot.
But interestingly, then you went to a more humanitarian type subject in studying law.
Yes, yes.
Well, which isn't maths or science based.
I know. I had no idea what I want to do, right? Like I ended up being accepted to study a combined degree, commerce with a major in finance and law. I had no idea at the time. I went to university in 97. We immigrated to Australia in March 94. It was a few years in. Nobody from my family went to university in Australia at the time. I remember my career advisor. I was very stubborn. Maybe not. But I remember my career advisor at school. Just given that I was studying, you know, 4-unit maths and 4-unit science, she said, "Oh, you've got to do IT. You've got to be like a computer programmer." And I'm like, "Oh, I don't know. Like, it's not me. I'm not sure. I'm really interested." So I was a little bit stubborn, basically, at the time that I didn't follow the recommendation of my school career advisor, probably much to her disappointment. And because I didn't quite know what I want to do, I thought I'll go and study, you know, something that will just keep the options.
Yeah, it's a good general degree, and it also helps you learn how the system works in general. If you're going to go into business.
For sure.
Well, you got the commerce there as well. So you got through that, and then you went and worked as a lawyer for a little while.
Yes, yes.
But you didn't stick at that. You found your way into a finance company.
Yes.
So explain that. What was drawing you there? What was the magnet to get you across to...
Well, look, I think I I think I probably realized early on that I'm not going to be a great lawyer because I'm somewhat opinionated. You know, great lawyers, you know, are good at taking instructions from clients and implementing those instructions, you know, bringing them into life. And I had no shortage of views and opinions. The other thing that I did not like about the world of a large law firm was the hierarchy involved. I'm a huge believer in meritocracy, and I have observed, again, even in that first year that I was working, you know, in law in what was at the time, I think, one of the largest, if not the largest law firm, you know, globally, is the hierarchy and the fact that, you know, you had to do 5 years as a, you know, in this position, and then you get promoted. You have to do 5 or 10 years in the next position, and then, you know, you become a partner. And effectively, what I did not like is, A, you know, the fact that, you know, you have to take instructions and just implement them. That's number one. And number two, the fact, you know, that the big business, the world of a big business or a big law firm in that particular instance was quite hierarchical. And it did not reward, and it did not have the flexibility to reward meritocracy. And that was the one thing that I very clearly took away. And I wanted to make sure that whatever I do, it's going to be a lot more aligned to meritocracy.
Yeah, I can hear your grandfather's words
coming
through
there.
But you ended up at Pengana, and you ended up with working with future Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull and his partner Russell Palmer.
Yes. What,
there were some key takeaways from that. Did you learn anything from those two gentlemen? And did you learn anything from that job that got you, you know, the foundations for what was ahead?
Yeah, and of course. So so just to clarify, I was involved in helping both Malcolm Turnbull and Russell Palmer start Pengana. I mean, I was a very young guy.
As a lawyer at that time?
I was doing everything, basically. And it wasn't just Pengana. So there were a number of other businesses, most in the financial services space, that I was involved in helping them, basically, with. I was a young guy. I was extremely, you know, hardworking. There was no shortage of work to do. And I had this baptism by fire, basically. I was, again, super fortunate in my life to have been presented with that opportunity. And I thought, look, okay, this is like an amazing opportunity. Of course, I didn't know at the time that Turnbull is going to end up going into politics, becoming prime minister. But, geez, I've learned a lot. I've learned some things that I have, you know, taken away with me as things that I want to do. I've learned certain things that I decided not to do, basically. There were lessons of what not to do as well.
Don't go into politics.
Yeah, well, that's certainly one that's applicable to me. But there were lots of lessons. And, you know, in a reasonably short period of time, I ended up just being immersed, basically, in the world of commerce, in the world of business, in the world of entrepreneurship. And that was an incredible, incredible learning experience, for sure.
So all the barriers were taken away there, it sounded like. You found your mark, that's where you wanted to be. But from what I gather in our previous conversations, it was also a period about learning about active investing.
Oh, God, yeah.
During that period.
Oh, yeah.
Where you met a lot of active investors. Did you want to run us through that?
And yeah.
Because it obviously got your mind ticking over that there's something not quite working properly here.
I was so impressed, I can tell you. Like, almost like as a young, impressionable man, you know, I was meeting all of these incredibly impressive, incredibly articulate, and very self-assured, you know, individuals, basically, who
talked fund managers.
Fund managers, exactly. Talked a great game, had a really good pitch. And then I looked at evidence, basically, and the evidence was mixed, of course. I mean, they all had, you know, phenomenal way of presenting themselves and articulating the story and the strategy. But the evidence of performance, of course, was quite mixed. You know, some were doing great, and then they weren't. Some were doing really badly, and then you couldn't see them anywhere around the office when they were doing badly. And then the fortunes turn, and they start performing well, and they bang the table, and they're back. And it was really fascinating. It was very entertaining. There was no question about the fact it was very entertaining. But those were some of the earlier, you know, observations that I had on the fact that, hey, like, you know, somebody can be very smart, very articulate, and still they can't beat the, you know, sort of they can't beat the market or can't beat the index, and, you know, and vice versa. And that got me thinking, basically. It got me thinking, okay, what does it look like across the entire industry? I started looking at the numbers. It was very evident at the time that index investing which was, you know, the thing that I kind of started thinking about, was very nascent still. Yes, you know, you had Vanguard unlisted funds, and there were, you know, sort of a number of others. State Street had, you know, a bunch of unlisted funds as well in the market, but it was not well developed. And I started looking at opportunities and started thinking about, geez, is there a different way, you know, sort of for the average Australian to invest?
Well, let's go to that. That's where BetaShares is getting born at
yes.
this age in your own mind.
Yes.
Just maybe run us through. There was the fact-finding tour of the US where you got to meet quite a few people.
Yes.
There was how do I put this together. There was the emergence of ETFs.
Yes.
They became more prevalent. It took a while in Australia to appear. Just that period, so you're working in the finance sector. How do you get the confidence to say, okay, I'm going to start something up?
Look, in summary, I was crazy.
And what did you
I
need
was
to
crazy.
Do?
I mean, I don't know. Confidence is good, but it was a combination of confidence and a bit of madness. First of our children was born at the end of 2008. And that was the time, I mean, we were like in the middle of, obviously, you know, it was a global financial crisis, there were lots of things happening in the world. And, you know, there were some fund managers that were imploding at the time, you know, who were utilizing, you know, sort of leverage and funky structures. And there was all of that sort of stuff. There was lots of disquiet, basically, in the industry. But I was possessed, you know, sort of, you know, by the idea and the opportunity to build something. I thought in Australia, we already had some early signs of an ETF industry. Spiders, and I'll be forever grateful to State Street for launching the first, you know, sort of ETFs, you know, in Australia. There were a few of the Spider ETFs at the time on the market. There was a gold bullion ETF that Graham Tuckwell, you know, had launched at the time. So there were early examples, basically, that, you know, sort of what might be possible. But there were hardly anybody in Australia to be able to learn from because the industry was pretty much non-existent. It was very nascent. And, you know, having looked around, I kind of thought, okay, I should go to the US. So, you know, my son was born. You know, I had some money from some of the things that I've done previously, working for, you know, for my bosses, you know, at the time. Certainly not enough to do anything meaningful with, but at least enough to have a little bit of a runway to explore whether something is possible or not. I went to the US. I was, you know, essentially at the time, you know, just really knocking on every door that I could find and trying to learn, understand, you know, sort of what's happening in the industry, why is it growing, what are some of the challenges, like service providers, like, you know, today we take it for granted, but at the time there were hardly any service providers even in Australia that were able to support an ETF business. So I've learned a hell of a lot. I've learned a hell of a lot in the US and have actually formed friendships, like even to this day, you know, sort of some of the, I remember I met, you know, the founder of WisdomTree at the time, and WisdomTree was really capable, I mean, still is a very capable ETF manager in the US. I remember sitting down with Jono, who's the founder of that business, and he had at the time, you know, what seemed to be a really giant business compared to, you know, what my ambition was, you know, for Australia. And I mean, today, you know, the business is like 10 times bigger than what it was at the time. And he was very generous with his time. He told me, you know, he told me the good and the bad. He told me that he couldn't make payroll like 6 months ago, basically, because, you know, times were really tough. And, you know, he was supposed to raise capital and then the deal fell through. He was telling me all of these war stories, basically. And I was like, Jesus, obviously it's hard, but it's
sobering.
Really, yeah, that's like sobering. Exactly. Very, very sobering. But I learned a lot. I definitely learned a lot. Got back to Australia. And we had a very small team at the time, basically a very small team when BetaShares just started. We had a tiny...
So you'd made the decision then that BetaShares would start.
Yes.
So you've got the small team. What yep. about funding? Businesses cost money to get up and running?
Yeah, yeah. Well, look...
did you have to go around and, try and find some investors?
Yeah, we definitely tried. A lot of people said no. And because we already had a small team, we were burning a little bit of cash. As I mentioned, I had some savings. I obviously had the opportunity... which I haven't really hesitated. I'm very grateful my wife was as understanding as she was, definitely dipped into our mortgage, you know, more than once and more than a little bit to really get things going. But I was lucky. We had an incredible, group of people. Most of those people are still in the business, today. And we've really grown up together, I think it's fair to say. I mean, I think building the business over what now has been, over a decade, it's not only a business journey, it really is a life journey. And when you go through, the hard times, with people, it definitely gives you an extra dimension of appreciation, basically, for everything we've got today.
And the first, I think you've told me before, the first two ETFs that you launched weren't that successful.
They were disastrous.
What were they?
QRE and QFN. QRE is the Australian Resources Sector ETF, and QFN was the Australian Financial Sector ETF. I mean, those ETFs are still in the market, and, between them, I think they probably have no more than $150 million. Out of the $37 billion that we have. Who's counting? And look, again, it was a real lesson in that, because at the time, I was so naive. I mean, I was spending time in the U.S. I was like, okay, what's working in the U.S.? Well, what's working in the U.S. Was the sector ETFs. So the broad market, S&P 500 and MSCI World, but sector ETFs were big at the time. And I thought, geez, we haven't got any sector ETFs at the time in Australia. We are nobody, beta shares. We've got to launch some first products. Let's bring sector ETFs to Australia. I mean, what a dumb idea that was. I mean, totally didn't hit.
So you should have gone with the broad index ones, because they weren't.
We should have done a whole lot of stuff. But we launched QRE, QFN, those two first products. And of course, I remember our tiny distribution team was calling our brokers. We started with brokers because we didn't have any research at the time. We didn't have any track record, and we thought at least we'll try brokers who look after the high net worth market. They'll have some more flexibility in their mandates. We'd call them up and they'd say, "Well, why are you pitching me, QFN, for example, the financial sector? I own the banks already. I don't need the financial sector ETF. I'm long, CBA and Westpac and whatever else." That was a dumb idea. And that was a real cold shower, basically, for me, because we were in the market. I mean, I was mortgaged up to here. By the time we had more of a team, basically, because you need to have, of course, legal and compliance and operations to get the whole thing, off the ground. And I was like, Jesus, this is dumb. Obviously, this is just not working. And that cold shower was very, very useful, not just for me, but for our team more broadly. And that was the first time where we kind of thought to ourselves, no, we've got to do what makes sense for Australia. We can't do what makes sense in the US. We have to do what makes sense in Australia.
And what product turned it around?
US dollar ETF. So it was our third ETF was a US dollar ETF. And at the time, currency ETFs did not work anywhere in the world. Nobody was doing currency ETFs. There were some in the US, but they were tiny. They didn't really work. And we launched the US dollar ETF. And we had more traction in the first few months with that US dollar ETF than we've had in the 12 months prior, basically, with QRE, QFN.
Well, it sounds like it was white space, because you haven't got brokers selling US dollar currency-based stuff, have you?
Exactly. And the banks were taking advantage, they still are, to a large extent, of the retail investors who want to actually buy some, some foreign currency. If you go to a bank branch and you're trying to buy US dollars, you'd have to pay 3% commission, basically. So if you're an investor, you want to have some exposure to foreign currency. Actually, it was very difficult to do that. And I remember that gave us the first taste of what product innovation can really be all about.
Is that still around?
Yes, it's still all around. It's still around, and it's gone through up and downs, obviously, depending on the currency and how attractive investing in foreign currencies relative to the Aussie dollar. But it was definitely a very successful product for us at the time. And again, gave me and gave our team a little bit of a taste of what it's like to actually innovate with the focus on the local market. And that was one of the critical lessons that I've taken away from that early sort of formative, days of beta shares. Do not ever assume that just because something worked overseas, it's going to work here. And also, don't be afraid to back yourself and introduce things in the market that you believe will make sense for the local investor.
Well, it sounds like you need to keep confident as well after the first couple didn't quite,
yes.
quite fly.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
Today, it's all proven today, as you said, 37 billion, 30-odd products, a lot of staff. It's been a great success.
Yes. So I'll correct you if you're not mind. We actually have over 90 products now.
Oh, 90?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, that's right. A lot more. Yeah, a lot more.
Okay. I'll definitely change what I talk to people about. They've got a lot more products to offer.
Yes, yes.
The other part to you, and sorry to get away from business, has obviously been the much, much more sobering topic, which has been the war in the Ukraine, which is your old homeland, as we said earlier, and that you've been very involved in drumming up support on a domestic basis, bringing the issue to Australia and being instrumental in the United Ukraine appeal, which is raising money. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and what's behind that and where that money goes to and how people can get involved in it?
Yeah, certainly. First of all, thank you for asking that question and bringing it up and giving me the opportunity to talk about that. Look, Ukraine is a country that you know, will never leave my heart, obviously. I grew up there. You know, Australia is my home, but you can never forget where you come from. And Ukraine's been very good to me. As I mentioned, you know, through my childhood, I was really heartbroken in the early days of the full-scale, you know, Russian invasion. I was very frustrated. I was very paralyzed, unfortunately, and just really glued, you know, to the screen of my phone and the screen of the television, just watching what's going on. I was very angry, very frustrated. But very, very luckily, my sense of frustration and anger very quickly transformed into a sense of, like, there's no point being angry and there's no point being frustrated. You know, the only way to be, and that's the only way that I know how to be, is to be active and to do rather than to talk or complain. And in the very early days, you know, my wife and I, started looking at ways in which we can help. You know, at the time, Ukraine was desperately short of ambulances mm-hmm. short of ambulances, because the normal setup, obviously, of any country's you know, medical system and infrastructure really relies on normal times. And all of a sudden, you have, you know, you have thousands upon thousands, tens of thousands, you know, people, you know, that are wounded in need of urgent medical care. And, you know, I've heard about it. I've got family still in Ukraine, mm-hmm. and I've got friends that I grew up with who are still in Ukraine. And it was very evident, as I was speaking to them several times a day, that there's a desperate shortage of ambulances. And that was the first thing that I've done, basically. The first thing that I've done is got in touch, you know, sort of with people at the time in Germany. And we have essentially went on a bit of a mission to try to find ambulances. And we found, like, you know, just through hustling, basically, and begging to be able to buy secondhand ambulances that we ended up delivering to Ukraine via Poland, basically. And that was the first thing that we've done. And I still have some of those videos, basically, of people, you know, recording, like, thank you messages and saying, you know, we've been able to do this and this. We've been able to save people because of what we had been able to do, which was tiny in the scheme of things. It was not that heroic at all, and it gave me confidence in the fact that even though I'm in Australia, you actually can be effective in helping and moving the dial for people. And then we started scaling. We went from buying a small handful of ambulances to buying, you know, much more significant quantities. We did it, you know, sort of privately. And then I had a few of my mates who said, hey, Alex, it's really great what you're doing. Can I give you some money? Can we buy more? Can we do some other things? And by that time, we started buying hospital equipment and beds and, like, you know, sort of other sort of essentials, basically. And I thought, geez, I don't want to be responsible for taking other people's money. You know, we do that for a living at BetaShares, but mm-hmm. we have systems and processes. It's robust. It's audited. It's accountable. And I thought, like, in my personal capacity, if I don't want to do it, but clearly there are people who want to help. And that gave me the idea, together with speaking, you know, with a dear friend of mine, gave me an idea of starting United Ukraine Appeal. And United Ukraine Appeal is a registered Australian non-for-profit that is focused on delivering humanitarian assistance to people in Ukraine. And we have evolved from early days. There were almost like days of startup, basically, where everything was chaotic, mm-hmm. everything was random. You know, you run into in all sorts of directions. We're now, unfortunately, in a position where the work to do is only increasing, of course, but the opportunity to help, of course, is very much there, like never before. We have expanded the range of activities of United Ukraine Appeal and really focused on some critical areas, basically. We focused on rehabilitation of injured and wounded people. We are operating a large rehabilitation center. It's called the Kyiv Institute of Rehabilitation. If those that are interested, just Googling, you know, the United Ukraine Appeal, if you don't mind me giving it plug, you can see details on the website about the Kyiv Institute of Rehabilitation, which is involved in helping people, you know, who are going through amputations, who are going through, you know, difficult injuries,
very difficult times,
surgery.
Yeah.
We are funding what is to date, to our knowledge, the only dedicated mental health helpline in Ukraine. As you know, the physical trauma of war is very significant and very damaging, but the mental health trauma of going through war is no less significant and unfortunately at times much more difficult to heal. And, you know, so we're operating and funding a mental health helpline in Ukraine. We have been involved in evacuations of vulnerable children. We have a lot of projects. We are feeding, you know, we have fed tens of thousands of people, basically, who cannot access, you know, food or don't have means, basically, to purchase food.
Incredible work.
Incredible work. And in many ways, the sort of work that saddens me deeply, you know, just thinking about the work that we have to
work
do.
Work, unfortunately, you've had
very
to
unfortunately, but at the same time, I am very, very lucky to be in a position where we can at least make some difference.
So it'd be nice to talk about the Ukraine more, but we're a bit limited
of
in
course.
Time. But I would like to ask to finish up on, how does the war end, do you think? Where do we get to? Because it's been a real struggle, and the Ukrainian people have done an incredible job to defend their homeland, to be the big brother, you know, fight them off. But at some stage, all wars end. Doesn't seem like it at the moment. How do you think it ends?
Well, look, before I answer the question, how do I think it ends? Because that's the most difficult question you've asked me so far today. I can say that I'm genuinely looking forward to the war ending. Mm. All people in Ukraine, I think most of us around the world, perhaps with the exception of Vladimir Putin, are looking forward, you know, to the war ending. As I mentioned, my days of childhood, people want simple things in life. People want peace. They want to enjoy, you know, their relationships with their family and their friends. Ukraine has been, unfortunately, you know, sort of has been dealt, you know, a hand, basically, a very difficult hand. And today, Ukraine is dependent for military support. There's no shortage of volunteers in Ukraine. There's no shortage of people who are willing to sacrifice their lives for freedom. Because again, having grown up in Soviet Union, I know that you know, the vast majority of people in Ukraine do not want to go back, you know, to the days of KGB sort of style regime. Basically, you know, people want their future to be oriented towards freedoms, towards, you know, entrepreneurship, towards opportunities, towards being part of a market that's open and free, which is Europe, basically. But of course, that's not to everybody's liking. I think right now Ukraine is in a difficult situation in that the outcomes of the election in the US are probably going to impact the future of Ukraine to a much greater extent than many of us had thought, you know, sort of even a few years ago. And, you know, it's very hard to tell. I think the honest answer to your question is that it's
There's
very
no
hard
doubt
to tell.
The White House is going to play a big role in that.
Indeed. But as you said quite rightly, Matthew, all wars end, and so will this one. And I am genuinely looking forward to a world where Ukraine has an opportunity to dedicate all of its, you know, sort of human resources and the talents and the hard work of its citizens towards building a future for themselves.
Yep, fingers crossed. Let's hope they get there. Well, good luck with the Ukraine. I know it's dear to your heart, and it seems like we're about halfway through the BetaShare Alex Vinokur story. So we'll probably have to get you back in a few years' time to see how it's unfolded. But it's been a terrific story. Great business, and it sounds like there's a nice road ahead. So thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you very much. It's been really great talking to you.